Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case set for oral submission this morning. The other cases are set for submission on the briefs. The panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Bob McCoy. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dauphineau. I wanted to announce that appellant in this case filed a letter brief. It has been filed. We have accepted it, and we are considering it. It was unopposed. Before we get started, I'd like to pause for just a moment to remember John Camp. Thank you. All right, both sides ready? Want to call the case?
May it please the court. The trial court erred in concluding that Section 101-106F of the Tort Claims Act, as applied in this case, violates the open court's provision of the Texas Constitution. As the court is aware, the LeBohm versus City of Galveston test for the open court's violations has two prongs, either of which is independently fatal to a plaintiff's challenge. Plaintiffs here fail the first prong because they cannot establish that negligent adoption facilitation was a well-established cause of action at common law. And they fail on the second prong because the decision to protect governmental employees from personal liability for their on-the-job conduct was the kind of reasonable policy decision that precludes a violation of the open courts provision. Starting with the first prong, the question is, of course, does the statute abrogate a well-established cause of action? And here, the real question is what is the cause of action? We're framing it as negligent adoption facilitation. Plaintiffs argue this is essentially negligence and sort of various negligence in various respects factually. But when you consider how cause of action is defined in Texas law, I think most recently by the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Ray Jordan, quoting from Black's Law Dictionary, it focuses on it's got to be particular set of factual circumstances. You have to have the right to sue under specific facts. And it's not so much the broad abstract, the way cause of action is sometimes used categorically. For open courts provisions, we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Agbar that it is a very context-specific kind of analysis. Also from the court's decision in the Trinity River Authority case, dealing there with negligent design of a building. So we know from that where negligent credentialing in Agbar, negligent design in Trinity River Authority, again, if you could just say, well, negligence will get you there for purposes of the open courts prong, the Supreme Court has made clear that that's not the case, that it's specific to the context. And in these kinds of analysis, looking at like medical malpractice is just essentially negligence in the medical context or design. It's taking into account the particular relationship among the parties, who the plaintiff is, who the defendant is, what their professional or what their relationship is, how they came to be adversaries, and that those cases establish that that really can't be boiled down simply to negligence, even though we're not disputing that the essence of their claim is a negligence claim. Just moving to, I will recognize that the first prong of the analysis is harder, I think, from our standpoint, only because there's less case law here. We do have the cases we've cited as some guidance, but it's not entirely clear. But I don't think the court even really needs to reach the first prong because the Supreme Court's decision in the Franca case really shuts the door on the second prong. The Supreme Court decided it was not an open courts challenge in that case, but the Supreme Court went through the analysis and recognized that providing this immunity or extending this immunity to governmental employees was the kind of reasonable policy decision that the legislature is entitled to make under the open courts provision.
So is Franca your response to their argument that it's just basically not fair because they don't have anybody to sue?
That's right. That's exactly right, Justice Gabriel. And it may be a harsh result looking at the individual plaintiffs in this case who are left without a remedy. The Supreme Court considered that same argument in the Rankin case, where it recognized that they're the plaintiff who was left without anyone to sue through no fault of her own, because the sponge was left inside her and it was unable to be discovered within the 10-year statute of repose period. And the legislature recognized this is the kind of balancing the legislature is entitled to do. The open courts provision is some restriction on the legislature's ability to change the common law, but it is the prerogative of the legislature to change the common law. And the open courts provision just requires that they be thoughtful in doing so, and that the means, if they're going to abrogate a well-established cause of action, that the means be closely tailored to fit the end. That's one of the things I think in this case that's particularly devastating, is that here the means and the end are almost identical. In other words, I would point out the plaintiffs don't challenge the means. They say, I think on page 30 of their brief, that they assume that protecting government employees is a reasonable policy justification. And for all the reasons we've set forth in the brief in terms of it both protects, not only it protects the employees, but it derivatively protects the state, because the state is obligated to indemnify employees by statute, and it makes government employment much more attractive and probably feasible even if in the absence of such protections for these difficult jobs like law enforcement officers and social workers, who are almost inevitably going to get sued for things that happen on the job. But going back to the point where a plaintiff's really challenge here is not the purpose, but they say the means, but the means essentially is the purpose. In other words, if the purpose, as they accept, is to protect these governmental employees, the means of allowing them to be dismissed from suit is a very closely tailored fit to that means. Their only response to that is to say, well, under the LeBohm test, where it says you have to have either a reasonable substitute remedy or a reasonable exercise of police power, they want to combine that into one test and say, if you don't have the adequate substitute remedy, then by definition the means was not reasonable. And that is not, that conflicts with a plain reading of the LeBohm test. And although the decisions going back to the 80s and the early 90s, there were some decisions where the Supreme Court kind of seemed to blend those, despite much growing criticism from dissenting opinions that I would submit eventually became the majority. The Supreme Court has never expressly overruled those decisions because it really hasn't had to, but I submit that those cases would not be decided the same way today under a correct application of the LeBohm test.
What, if any, consideration do you think that this court should make to Judge Birdwell's in loco parentis theory?
The in loco parentis theory was an interesting way, I think, to try to get around the first prong of the test, but I would say, because they haven't cited, that is a legal construct or legal concept that may have been established in the law, in the common law at the time of the adoption of 11106, but I don't think it really changes the analysis here, because they're not able to point to a case where that's applied in this kind of context. And if it were the case that you could say, well, the legal construct existed at common law, and therefore we can apply that and create the new cause of action and get by on the first prong of the open courts analysis, the Agbor case would have come out differently, because the negligent credentialing cause of action in that case, you could look back and say, well, all the pieces were in place. The only question is whether Texas had recognized that you could bring this kind of action against a hospital for the improper credentialing of a doctor. The Supreme Court said no. In fact, it just said, we haven't recognized it. The courts of appeals were split. We're not saying that you could never bring that cause of action, but we're saying it was not well established at common law for purposes of open courts. And that's what I would say, the same thing about in loco parentis. Not that the concept wasn't available at common law, but that it wasn't recognized for purposes of a cause of action, the specific facts that would give rise to the claim. Another point I would like to make is that in their brief and below, the plaintiffs have pointed to this as a very broad abrogation of the right to sue government employees. And it is certainly true in the sense that it's broad in that it doesn't distinguish, it's all governmental employees, it's state and it's at some local levels as well. But it's not quite that broad when you consider that all it's really doing, a number of these situations where a suit would be brought against a governmental employee would be barred by official immunity under the common law. And so what 101-106F really did was to remove all the litigation about whether someone is entitled to official immunity, which, as the Supreme Court has recognized, is often a very difficult determination. The law on that has been kind of fuzzy, and it's expensive, and that ties up judicial resources and the party's resources as well, and it just took that off the table and said we're not going to be fighting about that because essentially that can kind of come down to a trial. You have to almost go to trial sometimes on those things. It can be very difficult to get summary judgment on official immunity depending on the context. And so the point is simply that by enacting 101-106F, it's not that suit could have been brought against all those employees in all those situations under the common law. It only fits the what I would argue is the relatively narrow band where a particular circumstance or a particular employee would not have been entitled to official immunity under the common law, and yet they do fall under 101-106F in terms of acting in the general scope of their employment. So again, we're not talking here about where you have a rogue employee who goes off and commits some horrific intentional act that is outside the course of their employment. That's not covered by 101-106 anyway. We're talking mostly about negligence type cause of actions here, and the legislature made, we submit, the very reasonable decision to protect those employees, and the Supreme Court has agreed with that. The plaintiffs, recognizing, I think, that FRANCA is fatal to their case, they make three arguments to get around FRANCA. One is they've argued that the court misinterpreted the language. That ship, I think, has sailed. Justice Hecht's opinion was supported by a clear majority of the court in the dissent. Justice Medina, the author dissenting opinion, has since left the court. So I don't think we're going to see a change in that anytime soon. They argue that the conclusion that this was a reasonable policy decision that this, FRANCA made was dicta, and that is certainly true. But it was considered dicta because the dissent raised the point or raised the suggestion that the majority's interpretations could cause open courts problems. And it was for that reason that the majority went through the lengthy explanation of the history of the Tort Claims Act and explained why we've always had this kind of grand bargain that the tort claims has always represented of giving away the state's valuable immunity in exchange for granting immunity to its employees. And the point being that when it first did so in 1969, it did so in a way that was frankly pretty ineffective in the sense that it said it gave immunity to employees, but only in the very limited circumstance where you first obtained a judgment or a settlement against the governmental entity first. And of course, it didn't take very long for plaintiffs to circumvent that and just change the order of how they obtained the judgment and the settlement. And so eventually the legislature came around and recognized if we're going to be giving away all this immunity, we ought to be getting something valuable for it in return. In the trial court, the plaintiffs tried to make the argument that you could only look at the 2003 amendment and not the broader context of the act and say, well, you know, this did everything for the state and nothing for plaintiffs, and therefore it was unfair. I think in their brief they've conceded that that's not right, that you can look at the broader history and in terms of the give and take to consider the history of the Tort Claims Act. And then their third argument is that even if immunizing government employees was a reasonable policy decision, that this was not, 101-106F is not a reasonable means to achieve that. I've already addressed that point. The means and the goal itself are almost indistinguishable. And here it just boils down to their argument that you can't ever have, that you can't ever abrogate everything without the reasonable substitute. And that's simply, that just flies in the face of the LeBohm decision. And at the end of the day, plaintiff's disagreement with Franca does not mean that the trial court's decision was correct. Unless the court has anything further, I'll reserve the remainder
any
of my
questions?
Time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We agree basically on the framework that this that the open courts looks at, one, whether there's a restriction on a common law right, and two, whether it was reasonable. I'm going to turn to the second prong first, because he appears to concede that they're weaker on the first prong. So I'm going to turn to the question of reasonableness. Now, he's very succinctly stated the government's position on this, that the decision to protect government employees was a reasonable policy decision. That is what the defendants in this case assert is required under the second prong of the open courts provision. They base that decision almost entirely on the dicta in Franca. In our position, although
don't
this is...
Don't they also base it upon the cases that have been decided since then that have addressed open courts challenges to 101.106F?
I think they do. However, a couple of those cases, Hintz and Lally, I think is the name of it, those cases did not involve the current version of the statute. They involved the prior version, which at the time of the decision, those courts, I believe, agreed, like this court did, that it did not abrogate all common law claims. Rather, it abrogated claims against government employees only in those situations where government immunity was waived. So it provided a genuine substitute. If government
is
immunity
waived, Franca decided. Is
Franca,
it not?
But those prior cases, hence the other case that's slipping my mind right now, those are pretty much irrelevant. There's been only two cases post-Franca that have ruled that this is constitutional. They both came out of the first district. The first one was Williams. It's addressed in our brief. The second one was the one that they filed that we had no objections to that was filed yesterday. Basically what it said is we haven't changed our minds since we issued Williams a couple of months ago. It added nothing to it. Here's the problem with the Williams decision is it didn't address any of the arguments we've made in this case. It pretty much blindly followed the Franca dicta as well as the earlier in opposite cases that dealt with a different interpretation of the statute. Okay, it did not go into any of the case law that we've discussed here, the 80-year history of the open courts analysis from Hanks to LeBohm to Sachs to Lucas to Weiner to Garcia, which emphasized the importance of a reasonable means, that in order to have a reasonable exercise of police power, you don't just look at the purpose. That issue, as well as some other issues, were completely ignored by the first district, presumably because they weren't briefed or weren't fully briefed or whatever. For the same reason, if memory serves, none of these issues were raised in the briefing on Franca. The Supreme Court or the first district, so far as I'm aware, have ever had the opportunity to examine the full arguments we've made in this case from Hanks to the present. And so our response is, one, they haven't been able to address this. Two, even if their dicta indicates what they will do when this case reaches the Supreme Court, possibly from this case, even if the dicta may give a tip-off as to changes that the Supreme Court might make in the law, it has not made those changes yet. It has not altered, it has not overruled, as he admits, any of the decisions from Hicks going forward. The Sachs decision, the Weiner decision, the Lucas decision are all binding law on myself, on my esteemed opposing counsel, and on this court. And that's the position that we've taken, is that ultimately this may be a very complex decision when this goes up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court might very well change its mind and overrule its prior precedents. But the issue before this court is not complicated. The issue for this court, just as the issue for Judge Birdwell, was application of the existent precedents, not dicta that might be contrary to them. Did I overkill that question?
No, but the two-prong inquiry, the second prong, there's two parts to that as well, is there not? Whether there's a reasonable substitute or whether the balancing test shows that this was a reasonable exercise of police power.
That is what the language of LeBohm says. We do not believe that's the holding of LeBohm, but it is the language of LeBohm, and it's been repeated up more recently in Rankin and several other cases. I think it was mentioned in Garcia, et cetera. However, as we went through the holdings, going from Hicks forward, these are not two distinct tests, okay? They are, in fact, flip sides of the same coin. And you see that as you look at the actual decisions were made that were made. They can all be reconciled in this manner. The application of that test, the application of the reasonableness test, depends on the statute at issue. Okay, if you've got a statute that merely restricts, has minor restrictions on a claim by, for instance, requiring preliminary expert reports, by perhaps altering the timelines in some places, by altering the elements of a claim, there's no need in those cases for a substitute remedy. It has no place in it. Likewise, it might not in certain very narrow factual scenarios where a statute is so narrow that it would only apply to one fact scenario. It might not be necessary. However, the holdings of the Supreme Court have made clear that if you deal with a broad abrogation of rights, they must, that the means, the reasonable means, the second part of LeBohm's language, requires a reasonable substitute remedy. If that was not the case, you would not have gotten the result in Sachs. The Sachs court admitted that they had a reasonable purpose, that it was a reasonable policy decision, to use his language. The court reaffirmed that a decade later in Weiner. The court reaffirmed that in Lucas, and it went so far in Lucas as to point out that this balancing test, that this reasonable substitute remedy has to be as to the people whose rights have been taken away. It is not a societal quid pro quo is not enough, to use the language, I believe, from Lucas. Okay, all of these cases can be reconciled from beginning to end if you look at it as one test that applies differently to the nature of the statute at issue. And in this case, with the sole exception of the workers' compensation context, I'm not aware of any statute over the last half century that has approached the restrictiveness of this case. This case is a rough parallel to Garcia, the workers' comp case. In the workers' comp context, all common law claims against employers were abrogated, but they replaced it with a reasonable remedy that did not take away the rights of anybody. It altered the remedy, but it didn't take it away. It gave them a reasonable substitute. Nobody was left hanging dry. In this case, we've got the same situation. We've got a complete abrogation of all claims against a particular class of defendants, government employees, but in this case, we have an unreasonable application of that that's unduly harsh, et cetera. And very quickly, I'll turn to the official immunity issue. I don't believe that's before the court. I don't recall it being briefed at trial, briefed in any of the briefs here, so I haven't prepared to deal with that issue. But off the top of my head, it strikes me as being barred by the very first case in this line of cases, the Hanks case back in the 1930s. I think this is essentially the same, if memory serves, as what the court did there on the issue of whether the distinction between a governmental function or a proprietary function as to municipalities. And if I remember right, I think the case said it doesn't matter. Well, if it's a governmental function, there's no liability anyway, but that doesn't matter as to its effects on these proprietary functions. As to proprietary functions, this statute ends up being unconstitutional as to infants, as to incompetence, and as to anybody who for reasons couldn't provide the pre-suit note, a pre-injury notice that was required there, and it shut down the whole thing. It's the same type of scenario here. Here we do have a broad abrogation of rights on the face of the complaint, on the face of the statute. We have it applying, we have it leaving a whole class of plaintiffs, those who cannot get a waiver of governmental immunity against the state, are left without any remedy, and the plaintiffs in this case are left without any remedy, even though they have brought the various long-standing negligence claims, negligent failure to discharge your duties, which has been on the books in the Houston case for at least 120 years, negligent failure to take steps to remedy risks that your own acts have caused, negligent non-disclosure. These are all long-standing common law claims for negligence that are at issue here, and those claims have been completely abrogated by the statute at issue. They're left without any remedy. And if that is constitutional, if it's constitutional that you can eliminate not only those claims, but claims of any other type against a broad class of defendants, What is constitutional? What is not constitutional, rather? Could the legislature just eliminate the waiver of governmental immunity completely and say, sure is really important that we need to protect all these government employees, so we're going to take away the waiver of immunity for automobiles, for instrumentalities, et cetera? Could they go back to the workers' compensation context and say, we previously instituted a reasonable substitute remedy, but now, boy, times are tough. We really need to encourage businesses to come to Texas, so we're just going to get rid of that remedy entirely. We're going to get rid of the entire workers' compensation scheme and just eliminate employer liability completely. Where else might this go in 8 years, in 16 years? Does this not only deal with torts now, but start impinging on property rights as well, a few legislatures hence? If this statute is constitutional, if this statute is constitutional, then it wipes out the holding in Sachs, in Weiner, in LaBome, in the host of littler cases that were decided on an as-applied basis, Nagel, which was affirmed, incidentally, on the same day that Rankin was. All of those cases make no sense anymore. And furthermore, it leaves the courts without any meaningful boundaries on the open courts provision going forward. I can't imagine where it might go, but I know that we're in a vacuum of legitimate boundaries if this statute is constitutional. And very briefly, unless the court has other questions, I'll briefly touch upon the Rankin case, because that is, I think, the only other case besides Franca and the Williams case, et cetera, that they genuinely rely on. Rankin did not alter any of the prior precedents, did not alter Hanks, LaBome, Sachs, Weiner, Lucas, Garcia, et cetera. It did not eliminate the requirement for reasonable means in order for it to be a reasonable exercise of police power. What it did was carve out an exception, a historical exception, where it said, we have never held a statute of repose to be unconstitutional. And we declined to do so in this instance. It was limited to statute of repose and may even be more narrowly limited than that. But what the court did, the reason for this, the primary reason, was it said the open courts provision protects the right of constitutional access, but not an everlasting right. And then it determined that 10 years was a reasonable time to keep that right of access open, that it was the longest time period of any similar statute, et cetera. It went through a number of reasons. But that was ultimately the holding in there, that we're carving out statutes of repose, or at least one of this time limitation, to make an exception here. That's clear, again, from the Walters decision made the very same day. In Walters, they dealt with the related statute of limitations that went in tandem with the statute of repose, and they held that the statute of limitation was unconstitutional as applied to, I think it was an incompetent, but I could be off whack there. It might have been an infant, I forget which. No, it was an incompetent, I think. And in doing so, it based its decision as being controlled by the Nagel opinion from 1984. Nagel was one of the as-applied cases that is part of the Sachs line of cases. It followed up Sachs, came between Lucas, but before Lucas, et cetera. And in Walters, it held the statute unconstitutional as being bound by Nagel. In other words, it affirmed that this line of cases in the 80s and 90s, et cetera, are still the controlling law, and that Rankin was merely a carve-out. And I see that my time's almost up, so unless there are any further questions.
No questions?
Thank you. We ask that you would affirm the trial court's ruling. Actually, in 30 seconds, I'll make one additional thing. I believe you can decide this either as the trial court did on an as-applied basis, as applied to class, or facially. We suggest that you do one of the two latters for the reason illustrated by this case. This case has been going for 3 years, spent 2 years in the trial court, involved over a year of discovery in order to deal with the issue of whether this was an established common law right. If you would decide this only on an as applied to a particular case basis, that's a real risk that you'll leave trial judges with this issue going forward as to whether they have to make a case by case decision in each instance, when the only key fact is whether or not a governmental immunity has been waived in the case. Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you would affirm the trial court's ruling and remand for a trial on the merits. Thank you.
please the court. Just a few quick points in response. In addressing counsel's point that the courts of appeals that have weighed in on this issue, it is true that their analysis is really less than complete. But I think the bigger point is that Franca did do the broader analysis, looking at the history of the Tort Claims Act, and specifically went into detail about the reasonableness of protecting government employees specifically. So the fact that the courts of appeals have just followed Franca and written fairly short opinions is not surprising. The other significant point about those decisions, of course, there is the proposition of law. You can never infer anything from the Supreme Court's denial of petition for review. But I think when the court has denied the petition for review in each of those cases rejecting an open court's challenge, that is at least a signal that the court can consider, particularly together with the Franca decision, to see clearly where the Supreme Court has gone on this issue. In regard to the earlier Supreme Court decisions that counsel was referring to, the Sachs case, the Wiener, I don't know if it was Wiener or Weiner, those two cases in particular, I think, were unique in the sense that they were both the application of the two-year statute of limitations in Med-Mal cases to a minor such that the limitations period was going to run before the minor reached the age of majority. And I think they are kind of unique because the real issue in those cases was, can you look at the parents, or can you rely on the normal expectation in the law that parents were deemed to do best in the interest of their children? And that was really the dispute between the majority and the dissent in the Wiener case. That's significant because what that and these other cases have said is, I think the reason that the court was striking it down on the means analysis in those cases was it was saying this: the legislature has put forward this impossible condition. And due to the way, because the Supreme Court rejected the argument that you can rely on the parents, it said, well, in light of that, this limitations period puts these particular plaintiffs in an impossible situation of having their limitations period run. And so they found it unreasonable for that particular reason. And I think that reasoning is kind of limited to those limitations cases. The Lucas case, the significant thing I would say about that is that there the majority said that the court cannot rely on the benefits to society generally. And that, I think, has been overruled by the Supreme Court's decision in Rankin, where the court said that the determination that the collective benefits of a definitive cutoff are more important than a particular plaintiff's right to sue, I think that is, they did not come out and say we squarely overrule Lucas. They didn't have to, frankly. But that is an important consideration in this case, the examination of the benefits to society, and the Supreme Court has rejected that analysis in Lucas, and I think really restored meaning to the LeBohm test in doing so, restored independent meaning to that second prong and looking to the exercise of the police power. The counsel's assertion of could the legislature get rid of sovereign immunity altogether, the answer to that is yes, it could. And of course, that was the status quo before the Tort Claims Act came into being in 1969. In closing, I would just point out that in terms of the as-applied issue versus facial challenge, I think if the court looks at this as a facial challenge, their claim is it goes nowhere. But that really only applies to the first prong. I think on the second prong, it really doesn't matter because the type of that as applied or facial analysis is important on the first prong. On the second prong, you're really looking at these broader benefits and the determination of the legislature, and that is going to be the same analysis, I think, as applied. We would ask the court to reverse and vacate the decision below and dismiss the plaintiff's claims.
All right, so sounds like to me the big picture argument here is they're saying the language in Franca is dicta. The Supreme Court hasn't changed where we've been yet, and so we're bound by all of the precedents pre-Franca. You're saying, well, the considered dicta, I'm not sure there's a difference between dicta and considered dicta, plus the pet denied cases tell us where the Supreme Court is going, so we need to go ahead and rule that way anyway.
Basically, and I would add also that I don't think the holdings of Sachs and Wiener, for example, bind the court to the plaintiff's argument, compel the result that they argue for. As I said, those cases are distinguishable. I think they're kind of unique to their context, And so I think it's better for the court to look at the Supreme Court's most recent analysis of this and its reasoning. We agree it's dicta, but it wasn't something that the court just said, there's dicta and then there's dicta. And sometimes courts say things offhand, if I may briefly wrap
please.
Up. This is something that they were addressing an argument raised by the dissent and went off on pages and pages about why this was reasonable. And so I don't think this is a situation where the court didn't think about what it was saying when it made that analysis.
So your argument is that Wiener and Sachs and Lucas are confined to the facts of those cases, just like his argument is that Rankin is confined to the facts of that case, you relying on Rankin and they are relying on the others, correct?
That's exactly right.
And it's your position that Wiener, Sachs, and Lucas do not combine the two prongs of the second prong of Lebone?
I think that they did, effectively did. In other words, in looking at the reasonable, in deciding whether it was reasonable.
In those facts.
Under those facts. But I think that in doing so, it read out the first prong of the Lebone test, and I think the reasons for doing so really should be limited to that context in the statute. And that was Justice Owen's dissent in Wiener, where she comes back and says, look, even if we follow the holding of Sachs and we agree that that particular statute was found to be not a reasonable exercise of police power, we can't just say that's the same for every statute of limitations that comes along in the Med-Mal context. We have to look at this new statute and examine it on its own terms. And I think whatever you feel about the reasonableness of it, I think she was certainly right about that, that it deserves its own analysis as to whether it was a reasonable exercise of police power.
Well, we should all be glad that we don't have to decide is our last name Wiener or Weiner.
Anything else?
Ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we appreciate your argument today. Very helpful. Your case is submitted. And this court will be adjourned.